Hello, I'm your host Josh, and in this episode, I talk with Stefan about progress in society and his view of which values we need to cultivate for our future society. Professor Dr. Stefan Lawrence Sorgner is Professor of Philosophy at John Cabot University in Rome, known for his work on posthumanism and transhumanism. Often referred to as the bad boy of philosophy, Sorgner combines Nietzschean philosophy with transhumanist ethics in his so-called Eurotranshumanism.
So I'm joined by Stefan today. And so to start things off, could you just give us a brief description of what your paper was on at this conference?
So basically what I was talking about last night was to give an introduction to transhumanism initially, and with a particular focus on politics, religion, and sort of the impact or the relevance for transhumanism. And what I was particularly trying to highlight is firstly the current relevance of transhumanism, because together with Elon Musk, it really gained a lot of power within the political institution of the United States right now. At the same time, it was extremely important for me sort of to clearly distance my own understanding of transhumanism from Elon Musk. And Elon Musk had a close cooperation with Nick Bostrom in the Future of Humanity Institute at the University of Oxford. And he gave them financial support and so on. And he basically took many of Nick Bostrom's ideas and publicized them. So the ideas which Elon Musk presented, Peter Thiel and many of their friends, they're basically transhumanist ideas, even though they don't explicitly say so. But they are clearly, so they represent a specific type of transhumanism, which can be called classic transhumanism, because it's so sort of basically when public media talks about transhumanism, what they have in mind is the ideas from Elon Musk and his friends. So that was extremely important to distinguish my own approach, which is a Eurotranshumanist approach, from that of classic transhumanism. But also there are other approaches. I mean, the founder of transhumanism was Julian Huxley. He coined the term transhumanism in 1951, and he has had a particular take on these issues, focusing in particular on genetic intervention. He was also the director of the British Eugenics Society, but also he was the first general director of the UNESCO. He had a lot of political power and involvement with what he did. But they're also original transhumanism. Again, that's another approach. And I call them original transhumanism because they were actually responsible for providing the intellectual background for establishing contemporary transhumanism around during the 80s, at the beginning of the 90s. And that's in particular Natasha Vita Moore, it's Max Moore, it's FM 2030. And they had a particular take, and which is again very different from that what is being proposed by Nick Bostrom. And so, but unfortunately, in sort of the public reception, everyone's dealing with really some ideas presented, highlighted from the Future of Humanities Institute, together with what was dealt with and how these ideas were twisted by Elon Musk and his friends. And so they've got a very naive, single-minded understanding of what transhumanism is all about. So it's all about, you know, perfectionism, it's all about libertarianism, utopianism. It's all about just like, you know, the goal is to become a billionaire, to have a very libertarian understanding, and basically maybe to have your brain downloaded or the personality downloaded onto a computer in 30 years' time. And that is a very limited understanding of transhumanism, because a great majority of transhumanists have a very different understanding. And it's important to distinguish these various accounts of transhumanism, like the original transhumanists, Vita Moore and Max Moore. They highlight, you know, they are very critical of perfectionism. They're critical of the notion of utopia. They're also extremely critical of utilitarianism. They defend the virtue ethics. They are also rather positive. They have a positive stance. Max Moore clearly highlighted that his own take was strongly influenced by Nietzsche. And this is, again, something which he and I share, My own stance was strongly influenced by Nietzsche too. And basically, my paper from 2009, which became one of the most cited Nietzsche papers ever written, was a paper in which I highlighted a structural analogy between Nietzsche and transhumanism. And as a consequence of that paper and the various receptions of this paper, me with my background, in particular in continental European philosophy, so there was really a new type of transhumanism which crystallized, which can be referred to as Eurotranshumanism. And Eurotranshumanism doesn't mean that it's Eurocentric, but it means that it primarily refers to continental European thinkers, like from Heraclitus over Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, Goethe, up until Heidegger, and so on. So they primarily deal with thinkers from that specific tradition. So that, and it's more a recognition that this is the intellectual home, sort of the thinkers one primarily refers to and deals with, because others, you know, even though Max Moore has strongly dealt with Nietzsche, but his home is still more the Anglo-American world, even though he is critical of utilitarians. So it is extremely difficult and to have a nuanced discussion on these issues. So distinguishing the various approaches of transhumanism is fundamental for having a critical exchange or making any scholarly reflections on transhumanism. So that was a central insight which I wanted to highlight. Then secondly, sort of the enormous political relevance one specific take of transhumanism, namely classic transhumanism, has for world politics today. In that context, I was also mentioning tensions in between the Trump camp, where Bannon is a defender of, he's anti-Musk and he's anti-transhumanism, where at the same time Musk is a transhumanist. Then you see at the same time people in Russia like Dugin, who's a friend of Bannon. Well, at least Bannon and Dugin met up in Rome to discuss these issues and strengthen their understanding, their anti-transhumanist take. And they also met one of the Brazilian intellectuals who's supporting Bolsonaro. And they all share an extremely backward-looking religious understanding, which basically highlights, no, the Enlightenment was highly problematic. The Enlightenment was something they don't defer, their eternal values, and they imply even a more hierarchical understanding of the world, and they want to establish this, but not in, so transhumanism is enemy. According to Dugin, transhumanism is even the idea of the devil, and he identifies transhumanism with, you know, with democracy, liberalism, the LGBTQIA movement, and all the other evils of the world, which according to Dugin are evil. So he even says sort of the entire war of Russia against the West is a war against transhumanism. So transhumanism is really, within the contemporary political exchanges, has become one of the central reference point in, you know, in countries like the States, like Russia, in now even in Brazil, and people in particular in continental Europe, they probably never even heard of the term. They don't even care about this. In general, you know, with respect to many technologies, we haven't even reached the Middle Ages, you know, concerning digitalization and AI and so on. So it is important to take these aspects of transhumanism into consideration. And finally, I also highlighted the strong connection between the political side and the religious side. Stressing that transhumanism and religion and monotheistic religion, that does not have to be necessarily a tension between these approaches, because usually it's widely shared that transhumanism is something to be identified with atheists, naturalists, and skeptics, and there are many of them who affirm transhumanism, but it definitely does not have to be the case, because it goes along with a non-essentialism, with an ontology of permanent becoming, which leads to an epistemology of perspectivism, which means, you know, in the end, there is no judgment concerning the truths can plausibly be made. Perspectivism means that any judgment is, any philosophical judgment is an interpretation. Interpretation is such that it can be false, but it doesn't have to be false. That means one should rather take a more moderate, a humble approach towards one's own self-understanding, recognizing, realizing that oneself could be wrong and that maybe the others could be right, but the same. And that implies, again, an openness, taking care of other people's attitudes and understanding. So there's an intricate connection between religion, politics, and transhumanism nowadays. It's enormously relevant within the political realm, but it is, in contrast to what is generally done, it is utterly important to clearly distinguish between various different approaches. And I've only mentioned four of them so far, but then it needs to be important to distinguish between a silicon-based transhumanism, which basically aims for, you know, mind uploading. Then there's a carbonate-based transhumanism, which thinks that is highly plausible, but more a carbon-based further development is really plausible. Then there are also some transhumanists who are close to very social democrat understanding of transhumanism, like James Hughes. Then there are someone who's a transgender transhumanist, who, by the way, is also the best earning female CEO of the United States, is Martine Rosblatt. And so the political field, the philosophical field, is extremely diverse. And for people to simply say, and that's what even many scholars do, you know, it's all post and transhumanism, it's all the same, it's all evil, that is just utterly stupid. And a more refined and more nuanced scholarly exchange and discussion needs to take place. And that's basically what I'm trying to highlight.
Thank you. So I want to pick up on, so you mentioned the idea of utopia within what you call classical and original transhumanism.
Just classic transhumanism, not original transhumanism. Original transhumanism, like Max Moore, Natasha Mittermore, Max Moore highlight the idea of extropianism, which goes along with a strong rejection of utopianism. Utopianism is affirmed by people like Bostrom, Letter to Utopia, David Pierce also, it was his abolitionism, getting rid of suffering. Ray Kurzweil with The Singularity Is Near, or now The Singularity Is Even Nearer. And so they uphold versions of utopia, but most of the others are extremely critical of the notion of utopia.
I wonder, how does this fit in with a kind of a non-utopia and pluralism? How does it fit in with an idea of progress? Do you have an idea of progress?
Wonderful questions. Yes. Progress, once you have, so progress implies one criterion according to which, you know, something was worse is now getting into a better situation. And with perspectivism, with sort of getting rid of the possibility of an ultimate foundation, you're also getting rid of an ultimate criterion, which clearly justified, you know, something is better than what it used to be. So, no, I don't have any foundational criteria which clearly specifies that a progress has taken place. However, at the same time, I do have a concept which enables me to say, no, it is much better to live nowadays than it used to be 1,000 years ago. But I'm realizing and I'm stressing and I'm highlighting it is a suggestion. It's a contingent knowledge point. It is a contingent criteria, which I might have to revise given the relevant information. So I would say, I do say, it is much better to live nowadays than it used to be to live 200 years ago or 1,000 years ago. Why is it better to live better nowadays? Because now we've got, you know, many more liberal democracies than we used to have in the past. Then authoritarian governments were dominant, and now, you know, there has been a move towards liberal democracies in the world. 200 years ago, globally, the absolute poverty rate was more than 90%. And I'm talking about an absolute poverty rate and not a relative poverty rate. So it's not just being, you know, being poor in Monte Carlo means something different from being poor in Botswana. So you can make 50,000 a year and you're too poor in Monte Carlo. This would not be the case in Botswana. So, but I'm talking about an absolute poverty rate, which basically means having the basic needs to survive, you know, having a place to live, having some food to eat and something to drink. And that used to be higher than 90% in 200 years ago, and more than 80% in England about 200 years ago as well. And now then I'm usually asking that to the audience and to my students and wondering, what do you think what the situation is like now? And they usually hesitate before telling, you know, how high the poverty rate was 20 years ago. They usually say, no, now it's much worse than it used to be in the past. You know, everything's going downhill. And I've heard this statement actually by quite a few people here at the conference as well. You know, everyone's, oh, it used to be so good and the good old times. And now everything's going, we're going straight into hell and will be. And all the emerging technologies will bring the downfall of humanity. And then you look at the same thing, you look at the average life expectancy 200 years ago was below 40. Now it's 80. And in some of the more developed countries, even higher than that. And even in the really least developed countries, you've got a average life expectancy, which is significantly higher than it was 200 years ago in a place like England. So this is clearly, I'm not saying that's a fundamental criterion for progress, but based on the contingent understanding which I have, which luckily is widely shared today, I would say no. That this is a move into the right direction. That clearly it's better off living nowadays than it used to be 200 years ago. And the same applies to issues like, you know, just look at how long and who was working 200 years ago. You know, 6 years olds were working in the coal mines in England. 7 years old were working in the clothing factories. There were hardly any vacation days at the time. Nowadays, in any civilized country besides the United States, you have like 30 days of vacation time per year. On an individual level, that makes such an enormous difference. Just imagine you get up in the morning. What do? You've got your alarm clock waking up. The central heating is turned on, so it's nice and warm. You get up, you take a warm shower in the, you know, you've got running water. You've got a shower in your house. You go to the kitchen. You've got your fridge, which is keeping the stuff cold. You know, you've got a coffee machine. You've got freshly brewed coffee. You've got clean clothes because you've got a washing machine. You know, how many of the things did you have at 1900? Many of these things were not available. The same thing applies to things like antibiotics, to vaccinations. 250 years ago, we neither had anesthetics, no antibiotics, nor vaccinations. And, you know, this enables us to live longer and better nowadays. You know, basically most people today are living better than any king 500 years ago. And this is sort of the change of perspective, which I'm trying to convey, which I basically have. You know, just imagine what you're doing. And now we're complaining how bad the times are. This is just utterly, utterly cynical. You need to get a good sense and historical of the historical understanding of how wonderful the times are in which we live, despite all the challenges which we come across. And that was wonderfully described in The Better Angel of Our Nature by Steven Pinker, for example, who gave a wonderful summary of the various developments. And by the way, of course, I'm not saying just because technology has enabled us to live better, you know, lives than we ever did before. Of course, it's not a necessary development. It's not like just because it used to be in the past that by using technologies we used to be better, that has to be the same in the future. But at least we've got a solid foundation for making a climb. Now, we've got some good reasons if we watch out that we draw upon the right kind of technology, the technologies which are in our interest, they enable us to live, to increase our life quality significantly. Of course, if something comes out which clearly shows that it promotes paternalistic structures, totalitarian structures, then we have to fight. Then we have to stand up for it and make sure that these technologies are not being employed in a certain manner, or maybe getting rid of some specific technology. So it is up to us to making these changes. The changes or the situation is never perfect. It's always an as good as it gets a situation, and it's up to us to making such situations. But I'm really getting sick of all the people who are saying these times are so bad and everything's will going down. And even worse, it is not the case. And I'm aware of the challenges we're all confronted with. But just imagine 200 years ago, you were probably, you know, you were probably struggling just to survive. And this is definitely much better nowadays.
Thank you. I wonder how do you look towards the future, and what do you think we need to do in order to create a better future? What values do we need to cultivate? Would you put it in those terms, or how would you look towards the future? Because so far you've described, okay, 200 years ago, yes, there's progress, but will we also have progress in the next 200 years?
Exactly. So that's progress on a contingent criteria where I wouldn't say, well, I would say, and luckily I'm sharing that, so, you know, it's better nowadays than it used to be, but without making the case it necessary, continuous, and so on. So it is a very contingent criteria. And yes, I've made suggestions, and I do share. I'm extremely critical of like the paternalistic, of the authoritarian political structures which you find in China, for example. I'm also extremely critical for other reasons of a libertarian structures as you find them in the United States, because they also go along with very strong paternalistic implications between the ones who have and the ones who don't have. At the same time, I'm extremely critical of like Marxists who say, no, we need to get rid of liberal democracies in general. And some of these, they are even claiming, some radical posthumanists who are making the claim, well, the entire world, you know, the planet of the hell, the health of the planet is what matters. And we are responsible for the, you know, all the carbon dioxide emissions and the global warming. And the more humans there are, the worse the situation gets. And as a consequence, you know, that will the biodiversity dies out. And the proper reaction is, from their standpoint, again, it would be no, antinatalism, stop procreating, and, you know, and in the end, let's realize that humans vanish from the earth because humans are cancer of the earth, and then biodiversity will flourish. That is just cynical. And I don't even, you know, I never mention any names of the people who suggest that, but that's taken seriously in academia and in universities, and it's very specific political radical post-humanist background. So
to climate change, would you then say that?
No, that's not what I'm saying. That's obviously not what I'm saying, but sort of, I would say, no, we clearly, and it's obviously a much more complex argumentation, we need to find a technological solution for it, because if we find any other political solution, it leads to a strong totalitarian situation, which forces people to stop procreating and so on. In order to make sure, and we would have to have a world government, which basically enforces the same rules all over the world, because if one country adopts it, then another country doesn't, then that's not a solution. And what can we do in order to find a solution to these issues which function globally? Well, all the various member states have to adopt it by themselves, because the advantages are so big that it would not be in their interest not to adopt that. And when is that the case? When technologies are so good and so much better than the currently available technology that they want that. We need to develop these technologies which get adopted by everyone, and as a consequence, what also gets promoted. So what also gets promoted is basically better living conditions, higher living standards all over the world. That has consequences for the reproduction rate. So the higher, the better the living conditions are in the various countries, the lower the reproduction rate. So we've got, basically we increase the quality of life in the various countries all over the world, and the reproduction rate goes down. So what do we see here? So, if, you know, global warming is a central issue, we need to take care of it. But how should it be solved? We don't have a global government. We don't want a global government. We don't want to introduce eugenic regulations, you know, how many children you're allowed to have. So we need to have a technological situation, a solution, which automatically gets adopted by people all over the world. Secondly, we also need to reduce the reproduction rate, but by increasing the living standards, better education, clean water, and so on, and So that's why you know, any of these radical versions which has been affirmed by both sort of the radical transhumanism, which I, you know, like the classic transhumanism, but also the radical versions by radical posthumanism, they are not proper solution, and they have really highly problematic paternalistic implications. So in the end, I do cherish so liberal social liberal democratic system. In the end, so, you know, we've got what is being shared concerning the good life by most people. You know, we all have different inclination. We all have different wishes and different longings. But what most people do share is they think that their quality of life is increased if they live longer healthily, if they have an increased health span. So that's the one thing which most people agree upon. So that's why there's a need to have a universal healthcare system. None like in the United States, basically, where this is inexistent, 30 million people are uninsured, and they've got, you know, five-year lower life expectancy than in any other European Union countries, which are much poorer. And so this shows, and that's really a challenge for the United States. So universal healthcare system is an enormously important achievement in a liberal, social, liberal, democratic system. And liberalism mean in the end, it's an ethics of autonomy. At the same time, aware autonomy ontologically doesn't exist. Autonomy is a fiction. So what I'm defending is a liberal ethics of fictive autonomy. Autonomy doesn't exist; it's a fiction. But it needs to be a liberal understanding of autonomy, unlike the understanding of Kant. So a lot would have to be said on that topic. I specified that in more detail in my book, We've Always Been Cyborgs. So, but what do you need in order to actually be able to make an autonomous decision? So, firstly, you need to have an understanding who you are. And that, I think, you need to analyze yourself, get a better grasp. And here's what the virtue of mindfulness I'm suggesting, mindfulness meditations. Then you realize, you recognize some tribes in you, and you recognize these tribes are not being accepted by a wider culture. And then you get it scared because, you know, you don't want to be the weirdo. But that's why, as in second virtue, truthfulness is needed to accept the weird, the monster you are, and we are all monsters in one respect or the other. So besides mindfulness, truthfulness. And then as a final one, realizing sort of after you actually realize you manage to distinguish your the more core tribes to your existence rather than the ones which were created on the basis of TikTok and Instagram. They told you to, you know, get, you know, the cooler friends, the better looking people around you, and you travel the world, make money, get rich, and have a good time, and post your stories on Instagram. That's what this you know, social media world is telling you. But you need to have self-control in order to realize what to stick to the insights which you have grasped and say, no, that's not what I want. I have different longings and needs and wants, and I actually have a sufficient self-control as a third value to stick to them and to live in accordance with my psychophysiological demands. And so that is what I would stress as virtues which are central for basically actually, you know, living autonomously in the appropriate manner. And then, but that is just the background, which I think is appropriate virtues, which apply to anyone living in a liberal democratic society. But then there's obviously the question of the good life, which of the virtues are needed for living the good life. And here there's a great variety of different responses. And I've got my own response. And maybe that response is not being shared by anyone else. But the values I refer to are grandezza, raffinatezza, and fiducia. Grandezza means a sense of greatness. And in the end, that means whatever you do, really put all the effort and do it properly. You know, dedicate yourself to that fully and do the best you can in order to realize what you're doing. You know, don't get drunk all night, go out and sort of, you know, get mad at other people being successful and be sad all the time. You put the effort in, try the best. Whether you're the best in timber tossing or the best person in writing novels, you know, but just really put the effort in. Greatness, grandezza is so fundamental for living the good life. Then the second one is raffinatezza. That's sort of sticking to your own nuances, to your own idiosyncratic demands. What is it really that gets you you know, excited? What are the moments of high chinks which are really make you feel fulfilled? Is something probably very much connected to your own psychophysiological demands. And then try to develop that further and live in accordance with this raffinatezza. And the last virtue which I want to highlight is fiducia. Fiducia means trust. And trust is only built up on the basis of a long-standing personal relationships. You need other people you fully trust in, who've been through the trenches with you. You know, who've seen you down and who've been at your side. And no matter what, if you don't tell that anyone, they need to do so. And they stay at you, say they stay with you, and you can fully trust them because it's important to have other people around you. You know, it's not a solitary life in the end. And you need others with you. And that's really a tricky account, but because unfortunately, you know, people are challenging issues. So the trust issue is extremely tricky and fundamental. But so my own suggestion for flourishing a good life in the end are greatness, refinement, and trust. But what is generally needed as virtues for a good life within the system, within a liberal ethics of fictive autonomy, I think we all need mindfulness, truthfulness, and then self-control. So that would be the range of virtues which becomes applicable together with, in general, having no social democratic notion or political system, where it is central, the right of morphological freedom, and together with that also sort of one thing which needs to be offered by society is basically a universal health insurance, because that's the one thing which seems to be at least a prerequisite for most concepts of the good life. But for some people, it's also an intrinsic aspect of a good life. So being healthy as long as possible, that's really one of the most fundamental insights, and I think that's what most people agree upon.
Okay, great, thank you. This interview was recorded in Innsbruck as part of the conference Sacred Cyborgs, Exploring the Intersection of Artificial Intelligence, Transhumanism and Religion. The conference was organized by the Department of Islamic Theology and Religious Education at the University of Innsbruck and took place from the 7th to the 9th of February 2025.